The views and opinions expressed by guests on the TWBC podcast are solely those of the guest and do not necessarily reflect the views of nor constitute an endorsement by the host, TWBC, or the advertisers.
National championships, confederation championships, world championships, major professional events. For over three decades, he has been there for many of the sport's greatest moments. And now he brings you even closer to the movers and shakers in the world of high echelon tournament water skiing. From the founder and creator of the Water Ski Broadcasting Company comes the TWBC Podcast. And now here's your host, Tony Lightfoot.
All right, then, and thanks a lot for tuning in to the TWBC podcast. My name is Tony Lightfoot. Glad to have you on board. And this episode here is a really, really special one for me personally, and I'm sure a special one for a good few of you fans out there who remember the glory days of tournament water skiing way back in the 70s and early part of the 80s, or even going a little bit beyond that, because my guest here for the TWBC podcast this episode is Paul Seaton. How are you doing, Paul?
I'm doing very well, thank you, Tony. It's good to see you.
Good to see you too. Now, Paul, let's see if we can try and get a little bit more of an understanding as to your achievements within the sport of tournament water skiing, going back to the transition between the 60s into the 70s, and kind of give our audience a sense of where you fit into all of that.
Well, I started skiing when I was, say, 14. Skied in the National Junior Championships, under 16, under 18. Not long after that, made the senior team. My first Europeans, well, I was a reserve in 1969 when the World Championships were in Copenhagen.
Uh-huh.
I skied in Banyoles, which was 71.
In 71, yeah.
Bogota, 73. And then 75 in London. And that was the end of my career because I took a bit of a spill in jump, and that ended my career.
Okay, and in amongst all of that, all the way up until about 1975, you'd won a number of European titles, is that correct?
I did, yes. Yep. I was European champion overall, which was the big thing in those days. 72, 74, and 75. And then I won some individual medals, jumping in 72... 73, I won the jump again. 74, I won slalom. No, I didn't win the slalom. I won the tricks and the jump and the overall. Didn't win the slalom. And then in 75, I won the overall, and I think that's all.
Okay. And in 1974, I mean, the European Championships took place in South Africa at that time, was it? Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
Okay, and actually, and you told me this little bit of snippet of information, you know, because around about that time, a lot of pressure was being put to bear upon South Africa, what with the apartheid regime and all of that kind of stuff. And a little bit of trivia is the last international competition in any sport that took place in South Africa that involved official competitors from outside the country took place with water skiing's European Championships in that country. Isn't that correct?
That is correct. Well, as far as I know, I was told that we were the last team from Britain to go to South Africa before the apartheid ban.
Uh-huh.
And the event was at a place called Hardesby Port, which was near Johannesburg, not too far from Johannesburg.
Okay. So, kind of give us a sense of what it was like to actually be a tournament skier in about the 1970s. Because, I mean, you're here at Sunset Lakes, the home of the World Water Ski Championships in 2021, you know, and you're looking at the boats, you're looking at the skiers, you know, and seeing what is going on. Kind of give us a little bit of a sense of that by way as a comparison against skiing, which you see today.
Well, the equipment has changed enormously. I think towards the tail end of my career, well, the wake of the boat was large.
It was a Bosch, wasn't it?
Well, we skied behind Bosch, and then Correct Craft started to be used in tournaments in Europe as well. I suppose a big difference is the skier's equipment. My slalom ski was wood.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't use any fins. I drilled holes in the didn't use any of the foils, rather.
Uh-huh.
I drilled holes in my ski, and it whistled when I went through the slalom course. My jump skis were wood until about the last 2 years of my career.
Uh-huh.
So you didn't take two skis, you took three or four skis in case they broke.
Wow.
Then we started using the composite skis.
Okay.
But I was on 66-inch skis, believe it or not. And I jumped, I think my longest jump on those 66-inch skis actually was a world record at the time, but unfortunately Wayne Grimditch jumped a little bit further the same weekend.
Oh, wow. So, I mean, we're talking distances on 66-inch jump skis of over 170 feet.
Are you talking feet or meters? Feet,
well,
okay.
Okay, we'll go. We can convert between the two. So we're talking like distances of about 53 meters.
It was 176'6",
uh-huh,
which is 53.80 at the time.
Uh huh.
And Grimditch held the record, the world record, at 169. And then he jumped. I'm not so sure it wasn't in the US Masters. I'm not sure what event it was. But anyway, he jumped 180 the same weekend.
All right, then. And also there's a stark amount of difference between how one would treat injuries back in those times compared to how you treat it these days. I mean, I would go so far as to say that if you had the same kind of medicine that is available today to treat knee injuries and stuff like that, if that was available in 1975, you might have actually have been able to have prolonged your career beyond that point. Would that be an accurate assessment?
I have no doubt about that. I mean, it's so different now. The surgery I had is now very, very obsolete.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of surgery did he have in 1975 to try and repair? What knee was it that blew?
It was my left knee, and the medial came away with the bone.
Oh, wow.
I actually only had one cruciate, and that was discovered during the operation. I'd lost a cruciate before, but didn't know it.
Yeah.
Pulled the lateral, tore the capsule. I shouldn't be talking about this. I hope the skiers aren't going to listen to this.
Oh, they'll listen. They'll listen, but they'll know. But they'll actually listen and be thankful for the fact that there is such surgery that can repair those times of ligaments, if not make them stronger after surgery.
Yeah, I mean, they can replace ligaments, I think, now, can't they?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So but, yeah, my leg, I hyperextended. What actually happened was that it was a fairly glassy day, and there was a grass line on the shore.
Uh-huh.
And then there was a water line, and I misjudged my landing. I started to resist on the grass line rather than the water line.
This was at Thorpe, yeah?
Yeah, and the water line was a very similar color to the gravel.
Mm-hmm.
So I, unfortunately, and I trained there a lot, but anyway, on that particular occasion, I remember going over the ramp and thinking, this isn't a very good jump. And
no.
maybe that was the distraction, but it ended up being the longest jump of the day, actually, in the end.
Yeah. And that was the practice, or was that the preliminary round for the 1975 Worlds?
That was the first round, and actually in the 1975 Worlds, the jumping event was first. And they've never held it first since, So,
for those of you that wanted to go back into the results archive and find the results, they won't exactly see your name, because you jumped for jumping as the first event, followed by the other events, and unfortunately they won't find any record of you in the 1975 World Championship results, even though you actually went out there and skied.
No, they won't, because basically from Thorpe, I went to hospital and I was there for 2 weeks, and that was the end. And I thought I could come back from it, but the injury was too serious. Surgery that was available in those days was insufficient to be able to rebuild my knee.
All right, then. So, beyond 1975, you obviously couldn't compete at the highest level or do anything of that sort. You trying to kind of transitioned into coaching, and the site for your ski school for many years, ironically, was the Britannia Arena at Thorpe Park. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, initially it wasn't. It was Prince's.
Oh, it was Prince's.
I coached at Prince's for several years, but the way it worked was we were early morning at Prince's, and then we would go over to Thorpe in the afternoon to ski and coach.
Mm-hmm.
That was for a few years, and then I was offered the lease at Thorpe and took over the Thorpe site in 1971.
Mm-hmm. In 1971. Okay. So you have
Sorry. 81. I'm 81. 10 years out.
Okay, yeah. A few years out, but anyway.
Yeah.
So 81, that would have been the year of the next World Championships to have been held at Thorpe. And the first World Championship win for a skier for whom you've been credited in actually developing up to that level, a one late Andy Mapple.
Absolutely, yeah. Andy Mapple was skiing with us during the time we were training at Prince's and Thorpe. I remember him coming to Prince's. James Kahn and I were coaching together then, and he was the first one to go out with Andy, and he said, "Paul, you gotta get in the boat and see this kid." And the rest is history, really. He was very coachable. He couldn't string many words together at the time. He was very shy, and that was something I understood because I suffered from the same sort of personality.
And getting over the accent differences between being just outside of London and Lancashire probably that was an obstacle that you had to get over as well.
Well, not so much. I'm from Yorkshire.
Oh, okay, yeah. And so was John Battleday, incidentally. So a lot of great skiers are hailing from the northern part of England. But tell us a little bit about more about your coaching with Andy Mapple, because I mean he went on from that point onwards to be universally recognized as one of the greatest slalom skiers of all time, and I mean he started with you, so I mean obviously whatever you have to say so far as explaining the coaching regimen, techniques and that kind of stuff, you know, I mean certainly has relevance.
I've always maintained you need three things. One is a good head on your shoulders. The second thing is the right physique, and with slalom being tall is of course an advantage. And then the third thing is some talent. He had oodles of talent. He didn't have he was tall, but he was not strong. And the head was something that developed through time, and the hardest part coaching Andy was he would beat himself up when it wasn't right and he didn't do it right, so I had to work on that a little bit to encourage him. But we had to basically develop a new technique, which you know, he had no strength in his arms, but he had a beautiful position with a rigid back, a really rigid back that never seemed to buckle. And what I called it sort of controlled constant speed, and I think I shared it with you as well.
Yeah.
And it was more a case of rather than the LaPointe style, which I would call it these days, where it was a really aggressive turn and hang
crank
on
and yank and, it, you know.
Yeah, that's a good description. So with Andy, basically it was a case of a smooth turn but a real strong build up of pull through the wake. And then loads of deceleration before the turn so that he didn't have to take a snatch.
Mm-hmm.
And same again, just take the pull gently because he couldn't hold that snatch and build the pull through the wake.
All right.
And that's basically something that was a little bit different from what everyone was doing at the time, as you've identified.
Yes, and I mean, he was an above average overall skier as well, because I mean, he tricked and he jumped as well. You probably don't know too much. Not an awful lot of people knew that he was a free event skier. Everyone saw him more or less as slalom, but he was a halfway decent skier. He actually won the British National Men's Overall Championship at one time.
He struggled with tricks and he struggled with jump. Took some spills. It was a bit awkward on the jump, but yeah, he was a good overall skier, but his slalom was just in a different world.
And I mean, describe some of the sets that you took with him, because I mean, and I don't know if this was reflected upon me as well, because I trained with you in the early part of the 80s, and I vividly remember going not on the Britannia Arena, but skiing behind one of those big yellow Bosch boats on probably the roughest part on one of the bigger lakes that attaches to that whole Thorpe ski facility. You did the same thing with him to kind of toughen him up so far as rough water is concerned?
Yeah, we didn't stop for conditions. I mean, tournaments in those days sometimes would be on very poor sites, open sites, lots of wind. I remember Grimditch winning the World Jump Championships in 1969, and the only reason he won it was because it was so rough, and he knew how to ski on rough water. So I carried that forwards with my own skiing, actually, always training on rough water, and Andy was no exception. We trained in all conditions, even rain.
And I remember those rainy conditions myself, skiing out of, what was it, St. Anne's Lake, or I think St. Anne's was on the back side of the Britannia Arena, but anyway, it was that lake and the other one. So you concentrated on making sure that we were very, very round skiers, myself and Andy. I mean,
yeah, and you had a style actually that was very similar to Andy's. You had nice hips forwards. You never buckled in the waist.
Yeah.
Compliment.
Why, thank you. I do appreciate that. And I mean, going back to Andy, I mean, when you were commentating for ITV, which was in 1981, you were commenting over Andy Mapple's slalom skiing as he got enough buoys in both rounds, because back in the World Championships in those times, you took the score in the first round, took the score in the second round, and the World Championship was determined by a combined score. I mean, what was going through your mind when you're in the broadcast booth, whenever you see your product out there on the water heading towards a World Championship?
That was a challenge, because obviously I was the colour commentator, trying to make sensible comments for the audience, but at the same time had a skier that was potentially going to win the World Championships. No, it was difficult for me, I have to say, but
okay. So I mean, obviously Andy went off to the United States and did his thing a little bit, and then you continued to coach at Thorpe Ski for a good few years afterwards. When did you retire from that facility and head off to what is now your home, which I believe is Canada?
Correct, yeah, Canada. 99. So I ran the facility for 18 years. 18 years, yeah.
Okay, so and 18 years, and then Canada came along. And what was your main reason for moving out of the United Kingdom into Canada?
I would have to say that I found coaching, as you know, long hours.
Yeah.
Coaching is quite hard on a person.
Mm-hmm.
And I was beginning to feel that I wasn't doing the job as well as I could or should.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, Thorpe developed from only tournament skiers to the general public that would come down and book skis. So I tended to spend a little less time in the boat. I coached the coaches, but I spent less time in the boat. When a top competition skier came, I obviously contributed to their training, But I have to say I can burn myself out, actually, with the long hours I put in over those years. And, of course, I'd done a few years before that at Prince's.
At Prince's as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so we'll wrap up the podcast a little now by saying thank you for coming and talking to me. You're here at the World Championships at Sunset Lakes, and you and Margie are reunited with two good friends, Leilani and Jack Travers. Tell us a little bit about how that friendship got struck up a little bit, because you do come down to Florida and visit them on a fairly frequent basis since moving to Canada, isn't that right?
Yeah, we holiday together almost every year for two weeks or a bit more. It's a good story, actually, this, because it's a compliment to Jack and what he's achieved. In 1971, I won a Churchill Fellowship. I was awarded a Churchill Fellowship and came over to Jim McCormick's ski school in Winter Haven.
Mm-hmm.
Jack came down to he was basically responding to an advertisement he'd seen for Jim McCormick had an opening for an employer.
Wow.
Employee. I remember Jack driving in a red Mercury, whatever it was.
Uh-huh.
Jim talking to him and Jack driving away. And Jim got in the boat because I was driving for him. And I said, "Oh, who was that?" And he said, "Oh, it's a guy that's responding to my advert, but he's not qualified enough. So he had told him, if in a month's time, stick around, and if in a month's time I haven't filled the vacancy, I'll take you on." So we all actually got to know Jack, because he was in Winter Haven, which is quite a small place in those days, and we got to know him during that month.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody did fill the vacancy, so Jack came and worked there, and I remember the very first thing he did was build a beach. So he was up to his hips in water and reeds.
Mm-hmm.
With a scythe, making this beach.
Oh, wow.
And that's his start to water skiing, and look what he's done. I mean, in my mind, he's the best coach in the world. This site is paradise.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
And I went back to Jim McCormick's the next year, and by then Jack was driving and coaching, and it was very clear to me he helped me enormously from then till the World Championships when I hurt myself. And I could see straight away he was just a wonderful coach and patient and had a very sort of quiet, deliberate manner about him, and he hit the right note of you know, you have to have balance, you have to have positives and negatives, it can't all be negative.
Uh-huh.
Hit the right balance, encouraged, motivated, and he's now, in my opinion, the best in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's getting on in years, as indeed I am.
So, yeah.
But his two boys, particularly I think Chris, mm-hmm. has a real interest in coaching as well, and is a good coach.
Absolutely, and they keep the place running, and they keep it as well, one of the best facilities in the world. Well, we'll leave the podcast there. Thank you very much, Paul Seaton. It's been an absolute pleasure talking with you. Now, I normally offer my guests the opportunity to say thanks or give acknowledgements to friends, family, or whomever is worthy. So I'm going to give the microphone to you to say a shout-out to all of those good people. And Mike is yours, sir.
Well, I think a big thanks goes to the Travers family for putting on what appears to be the makings of perhaps the best World Championships ever. There's no two ways about it. This is a wonderful site, and they've done a good job preparing it. I think it's going to be a good weekend, and there's going to be some good skiing, but one thing I must say, I live in Canada, but I'm not Canadian, and I'm here to support the Brits.
Excellent stuff. And with that, we'll we'll leave this edition of the TWBC podcast. My name's been Tony Lightford. You've been listening to Paul Seaton. And until next time, it is ciao for now.
Thank you for listening to the TWBC podcast. Be sure to check out our website at waterskibroadcasting.com. Links to our presence on major social media platforms can be found there, as well as updates to our webcast and this podcast. Duplication or rebroadcasting of this broadcast without written consent of TWBC is prohibited. Subscribe to us on your favorite podcast platform and be sure to join us next time for the next edition of the TWBC podcast.